You're listening to the Kick-Ass Life podcast with David Wood and Dr. John Gray.
Thanks for listening to the Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter at The Kick-Ass Life, and of course at thekickasslife.com.
Jambo, fellow adventurers, this is Mike Dooley, and you are listening to David Wood on The Kick-Ass Life Show.
Well, here we are again. Can you believe it? My goodness. Welcome. Willkommen. To those of you in Germany. You know, I just so appreciative. You know, I always start with, I say always. Always is a funny word, isn't it? Always. I attempt to always begin my day with gratitudes. I've been doing this thing for years. People always ask me if I meditate. And when I was younger, I would have been 18 or 19. I fell in love with a girl. Love is a many splendid thing. But I was like head over heels. This girl was older than I was. I was just this little young punk. And it was just before I started traveling. And her name was Linda. And, you know, she owned a health food store and she used to wear these like pink dungarees and she ate organic food and she meditated and she ate all this amazing food and she had this kind of way of life. Her eyes were sparkling like I've never seen eyes sparkle. And you know, we had this kind of tumultuous and absolutely, you know, incredible love affair for this kind of short window of time. But while I was with her, she introduced me to meditation, and I got trained to meditate with, I believe, this is a lot of years ago, so Maharaji, I believe it was, and it was this guru who actually came to England, and yet you go away on these courses, and I went away on this course, and, you know, I had this just this amazing experience. And it was, and we used to use this thing called a bragon. It's like a piece of wood. Imagine a T. And so you'd put this sort of a little tiny post. It was about maybe a foot high and a flat T across the top. And you'd put your arms on the T and you'd be sitting cross-legged and, you know, you'd rest your arms. And there were four areas that we'd meditate. One was taste. And we'd put our tongue back behind our little wiggly thing there. I mean, my son would tell me what that is, and Google isn't up right now, so I can't tell you what it's called. Oh, my goodness. What a day and age. Answer to any question, the little wiggly thing. You can put that in Google. The little wiggly thing at the back of your throat. What is it? Oh, my goodness. Anyway, and so that would be taste, and then there would be sight, and you'd close your eyes, and you'd put your elbows on the bragon, and you'd sort of roll your thumbs, and it'd be resting on your eyelids, and then there would be a sound, and you use the ears, and then breath. That were the four areas that we would focus on, And it was just this incredible time. Imagine being this young boy who sort of fell in love with this girl who was really into this stuff. And we would sit for hours, and I'm talking about hours, a crazy amount of time, and just look into each other's eyes with this kind of soft and spiritual kind of music on. And we just look at each other, and I sort of something about connection. I don't know if this had ever happened to me, whether I would be as connected as I am to people. I mean, I'm sure this was played a huge part in this. And so we, even though this was a kind of a tumultuous and very short-lived kind of relationship, it was still a very, very impactful and very, very rich in this idea. Imagine spending hours looking at someone and with soft candlelight and really, really connecting. And I always feel that, you know, being able to see myself within someone and see into the very heart and soul. I know this sounds a little woo. We're a little woo-woo today, ladies and gentlemen, coming from the Podcast Central, The Kick-Ass Life, and we're on the Woo Woo Network. But I, you know, it's just amazing. And I, and since that time, I've always woken up. My dad's not a big sleeper, and I'm not a big sleeper. You know, I my dad was running on 4 or 5 hours a night, and I'm kind of the same. My eldest son's the same. Youngest hasn't got that kind of gene. He's got a gene that needs like 16 hours. But you know, but it's this incredible thing when I wake up, and I love the stillness in the house, and I just sort of, and it's kind of a funny meditation. It's not this thing I consciously, oh, I'm going to meditate, but I've got this habit over years and years and years of having this quiet time to myself when everyone else in the house is asleep, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30, 6, somewhere like that. Last night it was 4 o'clock for some reason, and being really present in my body. And sometimes I'll kind of drift into a sleep that's kind of doesn't feel like I'm asleep. It feels like I'm awake controlling the sleep. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. And I haven't been drinking, if you're wondering. I mean, I could be. I certainly would like to be. I'm cleansing today of all things. Now, here we go again. I'm cleansing. I can imagine that. And just amazing. I always feel great after a two-day cleanse. But the evening of the first day, I always find just a little tough. I always find that I could eat something. I could eat anything right now. A small flying budgerigar. You know, the vegetable that you always hated your whole life. I love vegetables, so I don't have one of those. But oh, I do, an eggplant. Whoever invented an eggplant? What is it? It looks like this weirdest thing. Yeah, it looks good. Or an aubergine. Let's call it by its real name. But an eggplant, I've always wondered. You know, people say, oh, I made this wonderful eggplant, whatever it is. And I think, really? Is there really? Could those two words go together? Wonderful and eggplant? I don't know what it. What does it taste like, really, an eggplant? It just tastes like what? wet cardboard. Now, I shouldn't knock eggplants. I've eaten them, and I tell you, eggplant in a lasagna, you know, when it's hidden behind a lot of other tastes, yeah. But it has that texture. Like, what is that texture? I don't know. It's kind of like a nothing. It's like a soggy cucumber. You know, like cucumbers are good because they're crispy, but an eggplant is just like, yeah, whatever. Reminds me, I love to make bread, and one of my favorite, I make all these exotic breads. And one time, I made a zucchini bread, and what I didn't realize with zucchini, and I went from an aubergine, how did I go from meditation to an aubergine to a zucchini? But here I am, I'm at zucchini bread right now. And I had this concrete counter made. Concrete's a great thing to make kitchen counters out of because it keeps it's like marble. It keeps cold, and you can shape it and form it. So I had this wonderful big central island made of concrete that looked beautiful, and I'd make bread on it. And the thing I didn't realize was how much moisture is in zucchini. So by the time I added my water to the zucchini, I'd added so much. It was so wet that I had to keep adding flour. And I swear on my children's lives that by the time I'd added enough flour, this thing was massive, this bread. And I put it in the oven after it sort of raised. I put it in the dark and talked love. I always say when you make bread, great bread is about, you know, you really having this moment with this dough. And I know that, ooh, we're all about moments today. I'm going real woo-woo on you. I'm sorry. It's just the way I'm feeling. I'm feeling woo-woo-y. I think it's the cleansing. Anyway, but I, you know, I always have this kind of moment as I'm kneading bread. I always feel this connection, and I always get great bread when I'm really present, when I'm making it. I don't know why, but I've made lots of bread. My favorite, by the way, I make this Moroccan chickpea bread. I should give you the recipe. If you ever want it, Facebook me, and I'll tell you about it. All right. Anyway, so got this zucchini bread in the oven, and I swear it's kind of like pushing the door open. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And in the end, I was such a joke that I ended up giving it to my friend Mike and Donna. Mike again. I'm always talking about Mike. I said to him the other day, I said, have you listened? He started listening now. Hello, Michael. But I said to him, I said, you know, you're like the Oprah, you know, Gail's friend Oprah. Mike's kind of my buddy I'm always yakking about. So I'm going to call him. Actually, he treated me today. He's a chiropractor. He's just got, you know, it's funny. He was telling me that he always has trouble treating my one side. And he does the same with his another good friend of ours, Steve. He can't treat him either, or his dad. So I said that everyone close to him thinks he's a crappy chiropractor. But he's not. He's really good. I'm sure to some people he's really good. Anyway, let's get on today because I got one of these great, oh my goodness. This guy has sold over 50 million books in 50 different languages. And 20 years ago, he wrote a book, a little book called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. And this thing took off, you know, and it was the best-selling book in the 1990s. Can you believe that? And he's written loads and loads of books since. One, Venus on Fire, Mars on Ice, Venus and Mars in the Bedroom. We talk about a lot about that today. There's lots of, I mean, if you have any issues with the word climax or orgasm, hey, you know what? Maybe this one isn't for you, you know. And it was a great conversation about creating better relationships and more connection, but understanding this idea of how hormones play out in a relationship and food and all these other great things that you kind of don't realize what's going on. So this is a goodie. And I was really looking forward to working with John, and we hang out in the same circles quite a bit. And so it's always good to have someone you kind of get to know and hang out with and have fun with and bring them on the show. So here we go. Listen in as we have a little chat. So firstly, I want to say welcome, John. It's great to be chatting again. I know we were together recently in California just a week or so ago. There's so many questions I have bubbling up. You're one of my favorite people to watch on stage, and you know my passion around training trainers and working with trainers, and you really truly have just a magical gift. But the first question I have is 50 million books have been sold of your work. I just think of 50 million people who've read the book, and possibly like my books, I share. I mean, sometimes my book will visit 10 other people. So that could be 100 million people or 200 million people who have physically sat down and read your books. How did that feel?
Well, it doesn't really register much, except that when I travel, wherever I go, people come up to me every day, wherever I am. People come up to me still, this is 20 years after the book, and say, I read your book. My mother read your book. I'm now reading your book. It has changed my relationship. It has helped so much. That's a very kinesthetic experience for me of delight, and actually makes me feel really good. Sometimes if I'm in a bad mood, my wife says, just go to the grocery store and pick some things up for me, because she knows people will come up to me in the grocery store asking me. You know, thanking me for the difference my books have made.
Is that when you wrote the book? I mean, obviously there was a time when you sat down and you started writing. Did you have any idea, or was it a vision of yours, or was the book written for a group of friends, or did you write it to become a blockbuster? I mean, what was going on in your mind when you sat down to write that first page?
I had been teaching basically the Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus ideas in workshops for about 10 years before I wrote that book. And I wouldn't call myself a writer at the time. I was a good teacher. I really loved teaching. I loved being in front of audiences and helping to inspire people, motivate people, and so forth. But people said, you have to put this in a book. You have to put this in a book. And my first thought is, okay, I'll do it. And I thought that if I put these ideas in a book, it will help motivate people to take weekend seminars, transformational seminars. And I really didn't realize that just reading that book could have such an impact in people's lives. I mean, some people say, I read that book 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and it changed my marriage. It kept us together. Something that still happens sometimes, it used to happen every trip I took, was somebody would come up and say, we were divorced and we read the book and now we're back together. And that was always amazing to hear. Now, in saying that, I'm not implying that everybody who's divorced can get back together if they read this book.
Or should.
But definitely they should. As many people have said, it helped me in my next relationship make it work better.
So with the, you're sitting down writing, obviously that's probably the gem then. You know, when I look at why, I remember reading the book, and that's got to be 17 years ago or so. And I remember having one of the things that stuck out for many, many years was understanding my own cave, my need sometimes to go in my cave and have that quiet time. But Probably the ability that you teach at, the way that you are on stage, that gift you have of igniting an audience, and it's so much fun. I mean, just to listen to you and the laughter in the audience. So people are sort of learning and laughing and really sort of reflecting on their own kind of relationships, and there's these kind of light bulbs going off all across the room. Do you think because you had that gift as a teacher, it really translated into the book, the kind of the fun side of it and the kind of way you write came from that years and years of teaching?
Oh, without a doubt. Now, I've been doing this 40 years, since 20 years old. I'm 60 now, and I started 30 years ago with the Mars-Venus material, and it was a very serious topic at the time. It was too serious, and I was not humorous when I gave my presentations. I was very sincere and thoughtful and had good ideas, and people would take notes and appreciate it enormously. But when I started doing the gender differences, people would take it the wrong way. They would get too serious about it. And I said, you know, I really need to find a way of lightening up on this subject. And that's how I came up with the whole thing shifted after I saw the movie about 1984, the movie E.T. And I kept looking for how can I share these ideas and have people be fun, have it be fun and light, and we can make fun of ourselves and not take it too seriously. Because when people take things too seriously, they get defensive into that right-wrong mode. And I wanted it to be fun. And I just happened to say, after seeing the movie, I was talking to an audience, and I said, just imagine, women, your husband's E.T. And they all started laughing. I went, this is it, you know? And so I started focusing on, you know, as if we're from different planets, and developed a little story, which was very helpful, particularly back then, in saying, now don't take everything I'm saying literally. I'm not saying every man is exactly this way, but I say men are this way, women are that way. And it gets too tedious to say, now, not in every case, not in every case. So if you just kind of, you know, make a metaphor of it, it became much easier for people to hear and to see themselves. And when they don't see themselves, to not beat themselves up. You know, I'm a man, but it doesn't mean everything I say about men, I'm exactly that. But sometimes I am.
When you started out, though, I mean, you're talking about 20 years of age. You know, I know for me, my work kind of spawned from some needs. You know, I was really struggling in my relationship with my wife. I was, as a father, there was a lot of things going on in my life. When I started to sort of search out and started to really sort of look at ways I could improve myself, it's kind of how I stepped into, you know, doing personal growth as a living, as it were. But with you back then, was it something you were wanting for yourself, or was it something, how did you initially start to teach on this? Where did that inspiration come from?
Well, it started 10 years before when it was back in the days of the Beatles. They went to India to be with the Maharishi. I wanted to see the Beatles. I was also interested in meditation and the Maharishi. I arrived right the day after the Beatles left. But the Maharishi inspired me enormously. And I said, now this is a very strong, confident, influential, powerful man who's having a good time in life and is really good. He doesn't hurt people. He's not mean to people. He doesn't use power to intimidate people. And I thought, this is a great role model for me. I don't know if I use those words, but in retrospect, I was drawn to that. He was expressing some aspect of who I was to become. So I was drawn to him. I worked very hard for him. I taught his trainings. I taught meditation. We called it stress management techniques at that time, meditation to lower stress. And it's funny, I'm still talking about stress management through our relationships. But I stayed with him for 9 years, and I was a celibate monk, a Hindu monk at the time. I'm Christian background, but he was Hindu, so I just sort of mimicked his lifestyle and followed his teachings, always being open-minded to everything, of course. And then after about 9 years, it was time for me to leave. It was like whatever was in him had sprung up inside of me. And it wasn't defined. It was just a feeling that now I have to go out and find my own way. And what's ironic is in the TM movement, Transcendental Meditation, if you were a teacher, you signed a piece of paper saying that you wouldn't teach their message unless you're part of the organization. So I left the organization. I kept my word on that one. And so I had to develop something new, which was perfect for me. And so as I was developing something new, I was studying psychology. And it wasn't like I had all this forethought out. It was one day after another. My major shifting point away from the Transcendental Meditation movement was my younger brother, Jimmy, had become bipolar in his early 20s. And I was using meditation and advanced meditation courses and techniques to try to help him. And it really didn't help, maybe helped a little bit. And it was around that time when I basically kind of felt like, well, I'm so happy and fulfilled in my life, but I need to go help my brother. So I left the TM movement just wanting to, not officially leaving, although it turned out to be that way. I just wanted to go to California and study all of the new alternative therapies and personal growth workshops and so forth. This was about 1979. And everything was just a hotbed of things at that time, springing up left and right. And I became a student of that, went back to school, got a PhD in psychology, and was teaching my own brand of, you know, self-help. Because I had this spiritual background and I was integrating it into the psychology and the principles that I was learning and developed my own ideas. From there, you know, the main focus of my work, having been celibate for 9 years, my interest was primarily sex. So and on a personal level. And so I wanted to teach, okay, what am I most interested in? I said, I'm going to teach these workshops on spiritual sex. And, you know, this was like the beginning of the Tantra movement, you know, taking the Eastern ideas around sexuality and applying it in the West and so forth. And that led to, and I would very honestly say, look, I've been celibate 9 years. I don't really know that much about sex. Many of you have had a lot more sex than I have. But I have a different perspective. I have the spiritual perspective. And when I started having sex, I had the permission to ask women what they would like, what they want. You know, most guys are supposed to know. But if you've been a monk 9 years, you're not expected to know. So women were very happy to share their secrets with me. And so that became part of my message. From there, it evolved into, you know, sexuality can be sustained, passion can be sustained only if you have love and you have good communication. So that became my focus in my own life, and I began teaching workshops on communication and love and sexuality and developed a counseling practice from there. And then I discovered that, you know, you really, one of the key frustrations that everybody was having is that they kept, this is back, you know, early 80s. And the whole world was thinking men and women should be the same. And so when I was counseling couples, I saw that this was the biggest mistake they were making. These are very conscious people really trying hard to make their relationship work. And yet if you expect a man to be like a woman, you'll always be disappointed. Men, if you expect women to think like men do, you'll always be frustrated and think, why is she saying that? And so I began realized I had a talent for translating what we're really saying, what we're really needing, what we're really wanting. And that gradually developed into the Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus message.
Philosophies. If I take you back to that 9 years of celibacy, I mean, for a lot of guys, you know, 9.5 minutes can seem like a long time. But this idea, though, that you really abstain from that sort of contact, was that hard in the beginning? I mean, was it like, did he go through a year or two and did it become more comfortable? Or was it just that the environment you were in was just so powerful as far as, you know, this beautiful place where you were so fulfilled that you didn't go that way? What was how do you manage 9 years and take that celibacy vow?
Well, what happened is, a lot of cold showers in the beginning, but after a while, and it does work, cold showers. But the key to it was learning to take that energy and run it up the spine through deep meditation. And so for me, it was a gradual process of continually lengthening my meditations to keep transmuting that energy. So I was meditating 15 hours a day sometimes for the last 3 years I was with him. I wasn't even out of my room that often. Although I would teach classes for him and sometimes be traveling with him. But a lot of it was just this really deep meditation. It kept getting longer and longer and deeper and much more fulfilling. I mean, it's people think meditating for 15 hours, how do you do that? I'll give you a context. You know, when I'm writing books now, when I get going in a book, I'll sit down and write, you know, a good 13, 14, sometimes 15 hours a day. It's like somebody who's really involved in their work. They're not, you know, they're completely engaged. Like when you're teaching a seminar, we routinely teach seminars 12 hours a day. Right, that's pretty easy to do. So you have to realize that once you develop that channel of meditation and going into the inner world, once the channel is developed, it gets easier and easier and easier. And it was really kind of like a spiritual form of sex. I mean, it was ecstatic, truly ecstatic for hours and hours and hours. It wasn't sexual, but it was ecstatic. And then, you know, I've been there, done it. You know, that's not my interest now. I wanted to come out and help the world, and help my brother was the turning point for me. And my fulfillment primarily comes from sharing and teaching and writing and helping people answer their, you know, challenges and so forth. And that becomes as ecstatic for me as being in those long meditations. It's being able to put your whole self into something, which is what I learned through that practice.
There's something you said, though, that fascinates me. Is this idea that you were asking women what they wanted, and women were able to share with you things and give you that insight into that, that sort of deeper connection, that both the physical and the mental. And I love the way you said it too. You know, most guys are meant to know what they are meant to know what to do. And of course, I was a monk for 9 years. I wasn't meant to know, so I could just sort of ask. That's a real pivotal point in someone's life where you get that kind of insight. And what were some of the things that women were saying that you think a lot of guys weren't ever asking?
Oh, well, you're going to have to read my book, Mars, Venus in the Bedroom, for that.
Well, give us at least one tip. Don't give it all away. Just give us a taste.
Oh gosh, give a taste. I mean, there's so many tastes. Well, here's one. Like, one of the chapters in that book is that women are like the moon. Is it for women? Their physiology is very different from men's when it comes to sex, in that a woman can have a climax and totally love it. And a woman can also have sex and not have a climax and totally love it just as much. And that doesn't make sense to a man at all. But if you put it in another context, you know, you go to the 4th of July fireworks and you go, wow, that was great. That was spectacular. You know, and that's an exciting moment. You can also have a picnic by a river and there's a nice warm breeze blowing by and the scent of flowers in the air from apple blossoms. That's a spectacular memory as well. You see, that's sex without the orgasm, but it's just as fulfilling. And women are much more attuned to that because their bodies are attuned to that. They're like the moon in that, you know, the moon has phases. Sometimes the moon is full and it wants its orgasm. It wants its 4th of July experience of release. At other times, it's the half moon. She could have that release or not have that release, and it doesn't really matter. And she doesn't know whether she's going to have it or not until she gets to a certain point, realizes it's not happening. And then there's the new moon, where she could actually be interested in having sex and getting connected and having intercourse, but she's clearly not about to have an orgasm, and her pleasure levels are not going to go to high peaks. But she enjoys the connection, and he's excited to be with her, enjoying with her. And she can feel his love. And that can be just as fulfilling as the other experience. Whereas we men, we tend to sort of label things as bigger is better, longer better, you know, bigger explosion, you know, that's what we're aiming for. And so if we don't understand this distinction that women are like the moon and men are like the sun, and that they rise every morning. It's consistent. If a man is aroused, he wants his orgasm, he's going to have his orgasm, he's going to be satisfied. For women, there's a lot more going on. There's a whole lot of different hormone balances and so forth that my later books write about. But at the time, it was just the understanding that, you know, don't be so goal-oriented. It doesn't matter if every time she has an orgasm. And that's really important because for a man, if she doesn't have an orgasm, you think something went wrong. Or you spend all this time trying to give her an orgasm and both people feel like frustrated it didn't happen and it's like a win-lose situation. You know, imagine going to a computer store and the guy says, he asked the guy, well, how do I turn it on? And he says, well, push this button and it will turn it on. But then he says to you, but on every day it doesn't actually work. You know, you can push the button on some days and it doesn't work. And then you push the button on other days and it turns on. So, you know, this is where men have to understand is that women are computers and they don't turn on the same way every time. There's variety is important. There's other secrets and so forth. But that's one.
That's great. And that's really a great reason for everyone to read that book. But this other thing with connection, you know, this where kind of you talked about a spiritual connection. And I know from my own experience, there's this wonderful part of intimacy that's kind of beyond the orgasm. And can you talk about why men challenge? Why is it such a challenge for men to sort of get to that place sometimes of deep connection with a woman? What's going on? Is it just that same thing, that moon, the moon sun kind of scenario, or is there something deeper going on in the brain?
Well, that moon sun scenario is going on, but there's a whole lot of other things happening. And you know, I can make some generalizations around it that would apply to many people, and then some that almost apply to everybody. I guess I'll start with that one, which is the hormones of sexuality are different for men and women, and yet similar. Testosterone is a big player in sex. Men's testosterone levels are 30 to 60 times greater than a woman's. Testosterone is in women, but just not nearly as much in men. And testosterone creates the desire for sex. So we become desirous of sex, you know, that I'm wanting to initiate sex. I'm in the mood. I want to have sex. That desire comes from testosterone. So men with higher testosterone levels, particularly up to about 40 years old, tend to have a much greater desire for sex than women, just because that high testosterone levels. Now it's starting to change. Even a 35-year-old man has much lower testosterone levels, so the desire for sex can be less. This is the thing to understand, is that one of the problems today with all the xenoestrogens and estrogens in the environment and in our meats and so forth, and pesticides and plastics, what happens is that estrogen goes into the body and suppresses testosterone levels. We're even seeing the decrease in sperm count in boys now is 25% less than it used to be, which is hugely shocking. And this is all due to the high estrogen levels in our environment. You know, my website, for example, I have some examples of how to reduce that estrogen and also practical things to increase testosterone. But coming back to sex, so testosterone creates the desire for sex, and the responsiveness, the ability to have climax and experience pleasure, increasing pleasure, comes from a hormone called oxytocin. And they discovered this in the 90s, that oxytocin was the hormone that allowed women to have orgasm. It also allows men to have orgasm. And the difference is why women are like the moon and men are like the sun. Men can, generally speaking, easily have an orgasm if they're aroused. It's because men don't run out of oxytocin very easily, whereas women do. They're running out of oxytocin all the time. You know, what you'll hear as a therapist is women say, you know, I'm giving and giving and giving, and I don't get back. So I'm feeling overwhelmed, I'm feeling exhausted, or I'm feeling resentful. And these are all symptoms of low oxytocin, because when you give yourself to somebody, when you care for someone, when you're nurturing, that's a nurturing activity. That nurturing activity releases oxytocin, and it's very pleasurable. So in the beginning of relationships, women are always very happy because they're giving so much. But unless their lifestyle and their relationship supports the rebuilding of oxytocin, then she runs out of oxytocin. She has difficulty having climax. She feels resentful. She's not open. She's not responsive. And she kind of blames him. When the real, I mean, ultimately comes back to, on a hormonal level, she's run out of oxytocin. Now, certainly he could help produce that oxytocin. But part of my whole message in my later books is how women can generate this oxytocin on their own, not just so they can be sexually responsive, but also it's turned out that the number one hormone that lowers stress in women is oxytocin. When a man gets upset, you see the fight or flight response in the brain gets activated. Men actually have a gene that turns it off. We can be all stressed out about the day and then shift our gear to look at a football game or the news or meditate, any of those things, and we can easily forget, with a little training, we can easily forget all the problems of the day. And that the immediately, like instantly, the amygdala calms down, blood flow stops to the stress center. Whereas women don't have that ability, they don't have that gene. And if a woman's really stressed, she'll ruminate about it. She'll go over it and over it and over it for days. So you'll see this, you know, since we're talking about sex, I'll give an example from that, which is, you know, a couple could be in a big argument and, you know, eventually they sort of blow off all their steam. The guy's ready to have sex, and quite often she's thinking, sex, you know, I got to recover from that whole argument. And it's because her amygdala doesn't turn off right away the way a man's does. And that's why we have all these differences when we come home from work and ways we cope with stress. And because the work world today, with more women in the work world, equal number of men and women in the work world, actually, the paid work world, what's happening there is the work world stimulates the release of the hormone testosterone. And here's the catch. Testosterone inhibits the increasing amount of oxytocin in a woman. So this is very interesting. Testosterone creates desire for sex. So there's many women want to have sex, but they don't actually experience the complete fulfillment of sex because they don't have the oxytocin to provide the responsiveness and the enjoyment and the pleasure. And it's irony, you know, we have all these permutations of imbalance, but when you get that kind of an imbalance of high testosterone, low oxytocin, you tend to have a woman who can become promiscuous, where she wants a lot of sex, but it's never satisfying and fulfilling. So she's always wanting more, or she might want different partners and so forth, or she might just give up on it and feel dissatisfied that she's not being romanced. But all this stuff comes from, on one level, from one perspective, and I like the physical perspective because it's so concrete and measurable. It's coming from the imbalance of hormones. And just like for men, their hormones go out of balance, women's hormones are going out of balance today because of all the xenoestrogens in the environment, as I mentioned before, plastic and pesticides and hormones they put into the animals that they eat, as well as the birth control pills, which is also hormones. Once these hormones get into a woman's system, it throws the balance out. What you have is estrogen dominance. And when you have estrogen dominance, you don't have enough progesterone. Estrogen speeds up the brain, progesterone calms the brain. So when you've got more of the accelerator than the brake, then what you have is excess worry and concern and overwhelm. That then raises stress levels, and that's the cortisol hormone. And when cortisol hormone is being produced, it uses up progesterone. And so now you have an even worse problem. Now you have even less progesterone, and the problem just gets worse and worse. And eventually it turns into lack of interest in sex, because progesterone for both men and women is the precursor to making testosterone. So that's what we're seeing today, is people's hormones becoming less, but even more important and more significant, they go out of balance. And that's the foundation of so many of the problems I see in our lives, in our health, in our wellness, as well as in our relationships.
So if I was to break this into two parts, just for a conversation between you and I right now, because this is my own sort of way of sort of, if we look at the environmental aspect of what's going on with the environment, the toxins, the hormone levels in bodies being sort of out of whack, out of balance. And I know on your website, MarsVenus.com. You talk a lot about wellness solutions, and there's a lot we can do there. If I want to bring the conversation over to the other side right now, knowing this, and I'm looking at some of my friends right now. In fact, I was out with a buddy of mine yesterday. You know, they're incredibly healthy. Both of them, you know, a couple of kids, they both work full time. And, you know, there's that whole kind of, you know, that intimacy thing after a decade of being together, is really waning, and you know, obviously they're both seeing it differently. What can people do, if we dissect the conversation into what can we do sort of physically around each other, emotionally, how can we converse, all of those things we can do in our home, and then knowing that there's the other part that we have to look at, you know, supplementation, we have to look at that, you know, the wellness side that you talk about a lot, and sort of working with the brain. But let's talk about the physical side right now. A husband and wife in a house, stressed out, both working, couple of kids, their love life is kind of going down the toilet, they're snipping at each other, or worse, nothing's going on, they're not talking at all, it's just kind of, they're just busy, they're like roommates. What's some of the things that we could be thinking about or doing?
Well, you know, you said a word there that I really like, snipping at each other. I was just in the store the other day and I heard this, you know, the woman made a comment and the guy made a snip back and she snipped back, and immediately my gut reaction was, they're not having sex. You know, it's just when you feel dismissed by someone in any way, misunderstood, judged, even in the little ways, what happens is it's very hard to open ourselves up to completely unite with someone. And that's what sexuality is. And it's interesting, the more conscious people become, the more self-aware they become, the more aware you become of how sensitive you are to certain things and how you're shutting down to certain things. And certainly what happens is you sort of lose the vulnerability, the willingness to open up and have sex. You know, what can they do? Well, you know, there's a huge range of things, but let me just, you know, people want little tips, and so I'm happy to give a few little tips that really will make a difference. Let's just take one element of this. I mean, it's really quite vast, all the things people could do to make their relationships better. But you mentioned they've been together, and they have children. So when they first came together, there were two people, and the dynamic of two, yin and the yang, creates great sex. And suddenly when you create a dynamic of three, yin and yang and creation, which is the baby, the sex is that duality is no longer just pure, and sexual attraction will diminish in the presence of children. And that's how we're designed to be, because, you know, if you look evolutionary at this, then inbreeding doesn't work. And so we have these natural hormones that get produced that keep us from being interested in sex with our children, for example, or around our children, to put it less grossly. And that's because there's a hormone called prolactin that gets produced. And when you experience a lot of oxytocin, which is the hormone of bonding, and you're here, you're sharing a life, you love your kids, you love your wife, she loves him, there's all this oxytocin, that's a good thing, familiarity and so forth. Then safety sets in, routine sets in, comfort sets in. What happens is prolactin levels go up in the brain. Prolactin is a brain chemical desire. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you know, every man has had the experience, as well as women, but men particularly have this experience of turning on the sex and turning off immediately. And that turning off immediately, meaning that he has sex, he has his climax, and while he's having his climax or he's having the exciting moments of the fireworks, he's going, oh, I want to do this all night. This is great. On and on and on. I never want to stop. And then boom, it's over. And he's not interested in sex at all. He's ready to go to sleep. It's done. It's finished. Now, that not interest in sex is actually the symptom, not just of low testosterone, but it's the symptom of the release of prolactin. And prolactin is normally known as the hormone that gets produced to drop the milk for women. It's associated with breastfeeding for women. But for men, when prolactin levels get released, it's associated with temporarily not interested in sex at all. So what it is that lowers prolactin, so you're interested in sex again, is the brain chemical dopamine. Now, dopamine is when there's newness. Whenever there's newness, dopamine gets produced. And so the more familiar you are with your partner, the more habits you're in, the more predictable you and your partner are, the less dopamine gets produced in the relationship. Now, women have understood this over the centuries. To keep men interested, they invented fashion and makeup to look different every day. And so newness and differences does stimulate dopamine. But for men as well, women need their dopamine stimulated. So I've given you the physiological foundation of this one tip. Hopefully it will make this tip significant, which is you hear it all the time, but people don't realize how significant it is. Plan a date. Don't wait till Friday night and say, what do you want to do tonight? Plan a date. You sit together on Saturday, you discuss what you want to do next weekend, and you plan it. And then the man plans it, and he does it. She gives all the input of what she'd like and what she wants. And then it's something she can look forward to, which is out of the routine of their life. It's not the same restaurant you always go to. You do new things and you get new stimulation. You go and see things, interact with people that are new and different. The anticipation of new and different, particularly for women, will stimulate more oxytocin. And it's an exciting thing to look forward to. What she's looking forward to is particularly time where she's the center of your attention, the focus of your attention. He's looking forward to doing something new. He's also taking a risk. He's taking charge of the date. When you take charge of the date, you're taking a risk. Will you succeed or will you fail? Well, it turns out that whenever you take a risk, you stimulate dopamine. So now you're including in your relationship, breaking the routine, the man taking the risk, the woman anticipating having it be for her. Her oxytocin levels go up in anticipation. His dopamine levels go up by taking the risk, taking the action, leading the way. Whenever you take lead, dopamine levels go up. Whenever you follow, serotonin levels go up, oxytocin levels go up, and prolactin levels go up. So what you want to do is get the man over into that dopamine world and get the woman more into the oxytocin world, and planning a date does that. So that's one good example. Don't wait to the last minute, men. Plan it ahead of time and take the action to make it happen. Now, what women can do to facilitate this, and this is called romance, is make sure that he feels successful. That gives him the courage to continue doing this. All it takes is a few dates where a woman was like focusing on the negative, like, oh, these beans are too salty, or that was such a boring movie, I couldn't believe it was so bad. It just sort of defeats dopamine, because dopamine gets released when you anticipate success. It's a risk, but you do anticipate success. That's the old thing about men liking the challenge. You know, you only like the challenge when it's gonna, when it's overcoming something difficult, let's say, a risk, but you do believe, you have the confidence that you can do it. Once you lose the confidence that you can make this woman happy, then things that, you know, things that would normally be challenges are just things you don't want to bother doing. You stop caring. And that's that, you know, been there, done it experience that, you know, we've all had as we get older, been there, done it, not that interested. What that means is that experience has become familiar and it no longer stimulates dopamine. But if you have a new experience or you're anticipating something new and add a little risk to it, suddenly dopamine levels go up and then you find your sex is quite enjoyable.
So with this, and I love this, by the way, this is such a simple step. Now, in the book that you talk mostly about this, Mars Venus in the Bedroom, is that's the title, right?
Oh, well, that's about the sexual skills and insights. What we just talked about is much later work that I've done, which is in my book called The Mars and Venus Diet and Exercise Solution. And it's not a book about going on diet. It's a book that explains the way our hormones work, our brain chemicals work, and how important it is for nutrition. Nutrition is just as important. Behaviors like planning a date is one thing to stimulate the release of dopamine, for example. But if you don't have the right amino acids in your diet, let's say you're under stress, you're not digesting your proteins easily, you won't have the fuel to make the dopamine, so it won't be effective. And that's what I saw as a marriage counselor, is I couldn't keep giving people good advice and have it not work because they weren't getting the right nutrition in their life. And about 10 years ago, I started really focusing, or actually 15 years ago, on and encouraging my clients, and now I require it. I won't even counsel somebody if they don't take certain supplements because what I say won't hold. And part of that is nutritionist shakes in the morning, you know, to have a easy digested protein with enzymes, with omega-3s. These are the necessary requirements, along with the right minerals, in order to make serotonin and dopamine in the brain to regulate these brain chemicals. And unfortunately, some of these minerals nobody even knows about. You can't even find them in health food stores. So that's when people kept saying, well, how do I find this stuff? So then I started just having my list of recommended products for certain aspects of improving relationships. And for me, David, it became very real about 12 years ago because I had pre-Parkinson's symptoms. And Parkinson's is one form of inhibited dopamine function. Now, what I didn't know was my whole life I had had a form of inhibited dopamine function, which showed up as ADD. So I was one of your ADD kids. And it wasn't until about 12 years ago that I completely corrected this. And I also took away the symptoms of Parkinson's by learning how to digest and assimilate the proper amino acids into my system and combine them with other nutrients that were necessary to make brain chemicals. So I wrote a whole book on that, The Mars Venus Diet and Exercise Solution, so that people don't have to be dieting their whole life and people don't have to over-exercise to think about being healthy and having healthy relationships. It's a little bit mistitled book. It probably should be The Mars Venus Wellness Solution, because as soon as you say diet, people think you're starving yourself, and that's certainly not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I want to just get back, because there's that sort of end piece. We've sort of the whole conversation, and I'm going to have you back on the show because this is awesome. And I know you could talk for days and days and days on this because there's so much knowledge that you have for both firsthand experience and really the millions of people that you've impacted and work with. The idea that let's talk from a guy's perspective, every guy wants to be a great lover. You know, I mean, I mean, not maybe that they consciously want to, but I mean, I think about, I have two boys, a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old, you know, watching them stumble into puberty and sort of watching them around girls. I mean, we were just out at the lake this weekend and Cal brought out his, you know, a girlfriend, not someone he's dating, but a friend who's a girl, you know, that whole awkwardness going through. And you know, when we started out the call, you know, you talked about that 9 years waiting and you asking a woman what she wanted. Is there any kind of tips you can give to when we just talk about the art of lovemaking? And I know that for myself, you know, I studied tantric sex for a long time and looked at that whole idea of around that, which I found very, very beautiful, very, very helpful. But what are some of the tips that you can give to someone who says, you know, when you finally get there to that point where you are going to be intimate with someone, what are some of the things that a guy could think about separately from a woman? What's going on in that bedroom?
All right. Well, again, you divide this up into 100 different categories, and you brought into this thing your sons. And I just want to mention something, because one of the books I'm working on right now is about the boy crisis. I'm doing that with another author, Warren Farrell, someone I recommend, a hugely brilliant, brilliant person who talks about gender difference as well. We teamed up to write this book because there is this crisis going on. One aspect of it is what's called the puberty gap. Girls are maturing quite because of this estrogen dominant society we live in. Girls tend to go through puberty sometimes 2 to 3 years early, and boys tend to go through puberty 2 to 3 years late. And going through puberty is maturing. So girls will tend to be much more pursuing around relationships and sexuality, and boys won't. And this creates its own challenges. And I kind of come back to what my mother told me, and although I didn't know the wisdom of it then, but my mother said, she says, you know, John, don't be in such a hurry to go all the way. You know, you'll have plenty of time for that later in life. There's a real great joy in just going through, you know, making out in the earlier stages of affection and touching and getting to know somebody. And I highly encourage that. The problem today is that girls, being so much more mature, are maturing sexually much earlier than guys. And so they tend to be much, much faster when it comes to sex. And this can have a whole effect on the male, which causes the male not to even be interested in sex. You kind of switch to polarity. Instead of the male pursuing the girl and growing in his confidence and sexuality and relationship behaviors, the girls are pursuing the guys. And this is something we don't want to encourage. We want to encourage boys to be the pursuers. So anyway, that's a whole challenge in itself. And, you know, at least to be aware that that's going on can help us. When it comes to what you're kind of describing as men in the bedroom, you've got your partner, to realize that women are, they have a whole different sense of timing. Now, see, men have on the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain, there's something called the IPL, anterior parietal lobe. And on almost all men, the left side is much, much bigger, much more active than women. And for women, the right side of the brain, the anterior parietal lobe, is much, much bigger for women and definitely much more active. The attributes of the left side of the brain all have to do with time and space. So for us, it's a matter of sex can often activate that part of the brain, and it could be 2 minutes and we feel like it was all night. You know, you could be, we don't have a sense of time the way women do, you know, and sex, they're kind of going, he didn't touch me at all. And he's thinking, I touched her for hours, you know? So there's, The key thing I say for men is slow down, slow down, slow down. And even before you get actually sexual, a massage, putting some oil on your body, lubrication is really, really good. Lots of movement, or even simply a foot massage has a huge erotic experience for women if she's interested in a man in that way. It can be a neutral experience as well. But a foot massage actually stimulates her body to make oxytocin, way more effective than kissing, way more effective than erotic touching. It's amazing phenomena. Is a nice sort of, in a sense, non-sexual foot massage, maybe sharing about the day or just being quiet, put some oils on, will begin stimulating the oxytocin. And then it takes time, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, foot massage. Sometimes you might feel more like doing a whole body massage. This kind of focused attention on her is really helpful for her oxytocin. And what you say to yourself during that time as a guy is put your arousal to the side as best as you can, so she doesn't feel like there's this, you know, push. Come on now, light up, get open up, open up, open up. Let me give you the flip side of this to help men understand this. And that is, you know, sometimes women want men to open up and talk about what's going on and nothing happens. You know, what are you thinking? Well, not much. And what did you do? Well, this. And it's like pulling teeth to get him to say something. In the same way, for men to open up that way can take time. You know, you might have to be working in the garden and then suddenly he just starts talking, or you're going for a walk and she's talking and suddenly he opens up. You don't know. You can't poke at it. You have to indirectly go after it. Same thing for women in terms of opening up. If you're too direct, it actually shuts them down. So a nice little massage, a little affection, some kissing. And quite often couples forget to kiss because guys, once they can get into the kingdom, they go, why bother with the kissing when we can get to the goal? And the key is the journey. Women are much more aware of the journey. And as men slow down to appreciate the journey, you find there's a lot of gold there that you didn't even know, lots of jewels. But at the same time, I don't want to discount the male race car wanting to get to the point right away. So one of the themes in Mars, Venus in the bedroom, and I do explain it in much greater detail because I have more time, is to create a permission and an acceptance for different kinds of sex. Instead of it always being the same way where all her needs are met, and then, you know, if there's another kind of sex where all his needs are met, and that would be Martian sex. I call it quickie sex, junk food sex, microwave sex. It happens in 2 to 3 minutes. And then he's not thinking about it. He's done. So, you know, if she's not really in the full moon and she's in a new moon, well, let's just have a quickie. And that turns out to be really a positive experience when it's an understanding that this isn't the only kind of sex we're going to have. You know, I balance out the quickies with gourmet sex. If there's a bunch of quickies, I'll make sure that we're going to have gourmet sex. And when I'm counseling my clients, you know, I make a deal with it. I say, okay, he gets quickies. If they're a younger couple, they want the quickies typically. And I say, Ark, but it's got to be a balance. This gourmet sex means a really, really special date and lots of foreplay, candles, music, and go really, really slow. That she can expect to have that sometime in the next 30 days if you have, you know, random quickies whenever. And again, there's guidelines that make it very easy. She's not supposed to breathe heavy and be all excited if she's only got 2 minutes. And so he can't say, hey, did you come, you know, or feel disappointed if she lays there like a dead log.
Hey, you know,
and, you know what I heard again and again, which was amazing, and all my clients love this, you know, the permission to have different kinds of sex, healthy home-cooked sex, gourmet sex, quickie sex, hot sex, cold sex, all kinds of sex. It's really good. So we don't have this performance anxiety and pressure. And at the same time, we recognize that people are different moods, different times, they have different needs. And let's try to accommodate our partners as best we can.
And the idea then that I always talk about this whole idea of range. You know, when we're starting out as I'm 51 and I look at this whole arena as being, you know, a lot of men. And I'm talking men because I'm a man. I can't obviously talk from a woman's perspective. But the idea that a lot of guys learn the first time, and whether it's great or clumsy, whatever. And I don't see a lot of men. I chat to men openly. I teach programs where I take men away on their own. A lot of men who kind of research and stay in the game and keep learning and expanding the repertoire and, you know, really understanding this whole idea of this beautiful range you talked about. I love this. I love the analogy of quickie sex and, you know, cold sex, hot sex, you know, I mean, this wonderful idea that we can get that permission-based range and having that much fun. Before we close the call, though, John, I know I'm going to get you back. And you know, Lara Lowe, she asked this question. She said, what I'd like to ask John, this is on Facebook, by the way, is are there any tips for a woman who are dating and want a healthy, loving, a monogamous relationship? How do we go from dating to a relationship? Do you have any tips on that for Laura?
Oh, yeah, I've got lots. And since she's on Facebook, she can also check me out on Facebook. Every day I'm giving tips out on Facebook, a lot of dating tips as well. But the key here is understanding the challenge. Always to solve a problem, to take a step in the right direction, we have to understand the challenge that faces us in clear terms. The challenge right now for women today is that men have it too easy. Is that with women, they're pursuing men much more aggressively than ever before. And again, this all has to do, one, with estrogen balance, but it also has to do with more women in the workplace making more money. When women are making more money, they often want to pursue a male who's making just as much money or more. They don't always pursue down on the income ladder. This is historic. It's traditional that way. It may change. It may not. But what I see over and over is women are saying, where are the men? And I say, well, they're down the alley working in the, you know, doing that job over there. Well, I'm not really interested in that guy. I want a guy who's basically got a house. He's got a job. He's making as much money as me. And so when you've got now more if we look at the statistics of single women, there are more single women making more money than single men. That's the new statistic. And actually, single women make more per hour than single men. They're actually making more money. There's 2-to-1 women to men graduating from college. There's 2-to-1 women to men graduating from high school. So what you see is there's like a shortage of men. When there's a shortage of men that you're drawn to, the next thing that happens is there's more women going after this one guy. And so the women, instead of the guys pursuing the women, women are pursuing guys more. And when women pursue guys, they give them what the guy wants. And basically, guys want sex. That's the thing that guys want. I won't say every guy is thinking about sex, but it's pretty much built in. If he's got good testosterone levels, high testosterone levels, he's always open to having sex. So, and it's very pleasing to him. So women are eager to satisfy his need, even when their need is not being met. And that's a formula for disaster. Never have sex with a man unless you feel you're looking forward to it and it would feel good to you and you'd like to do it. Don't do it because you think that if I do it, he'll like me more. If you do it thinking he'll like you more and you weren't really into it, he will like you less, and no harm to him. It's too much of an experience. It's too quick, and his tendency is to like you less rather than to like you more. It's interesting. Even right now, I'm kind of thinking of all the women I never actually finished with. They still, you know, they never go away. The ones you never fully got. But it's easy to forget once you've sort of planted the seed. So I want women to know going slow is the key, and it's hard to go slow if you don't understand that you can go slow. Women have done it for centuries. Today, men are getting it so easily. There's like this expectation. So here's a phrase, a little practical tip. When he wants you to have sex and you're not ready to, you can say, oh, my gosh, this is so wonderful. I'd love to have sex, but I found that in the past it really hasn't worked for me to do it right away, but I'm certainly looking forward to it once I get to know you better, period. That way you don't crush his ego. Because so for some men, if you say no to sex, they think, well, what's wrong, you know, with me? All these other women want me. Why don't you? And so to acknowledge that, gee, sex is a great idea, so he doesn't take it personally, but also set your boundary, it allows him to then experience his desire for you and have him do something to earn it. He has to win you over. He has to open you up. His actions, his consideration, his caring has to open you up. And then if he feels he has succeeded in doing something and sex is your response to what he did, then he bonds with you. If men have it too easy, they don't bond with you. They don't commit and they just move on to somebody else.
Well, thank you, Laura, for that question. Thanks, John. Hey, John, you know, we're coming to the end of the call. I just want to thank you for what you're doing. We'll get you back. And I know this conversation can go on for days, months, years, and it's something that everyone is interested in. So I salute you for your magnificent work. And I look forward to the next time we get to chat.
Oh, David, it's been such a pleasure. And I just had a little thought. Because, you know, so many women are interested in dating. I get a lot of dating questions, and a lot of them go to my daughter. So I want you to know about my daughter, Lauren Gray, is also at MarsVenus.com. And for people under 35, they can direct their questions to her and get a more hip answer than an old guy like me.
So if you want hip, you go to MarsVenus.com and you speak to Lauren. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. Thanks, John. So I told you there was going to be all this conversation in the bedroom, and, you know, that's the way it went. You know, I don't plan these things. I don't have these copious amounts of notes about where I'm going to ask. I always find just trusting that the right question is going to come up. And this is the way it went, you know, and I was really, I learned something. You know, I really felt like I learned something and that I can practically use in my relationship, where I can understand this role play. And I love this whole idea, you know, the moon and the sun. The sun comes up every day, you know, but the phases of the moon, and understanding how I can use the phases of the moon to be that partner that can really be that in the right place, understanding that the phases of the moon change. And with the phases, you know, I can be more understanding in those phases. And also in the bedroom, you know, understanding this lovely idea. And I've always believed in range. It's something I practice and I've really always believed. I always believe there's somebody out there that must be have the greatest love affair in the world. That, you know, they've experienced more depth, more intimacy, more passion, more love, more fun, more everything. And I'm thinking, that's, I want to be better than that. How do you get better than that? Well, you got to focus on it. And gentlemen, one thing I got to say, some of you have learned your techniques when you were very young and you've not studied since. This is something, there's like gazillions of things you can learn is go out there and learn. Become a masterful lover. So today's homework, ladies and gentlemen, become beautiful lovers and, you know, move with the cycles of the moon. And again, those of you that are in same-sex relationships and have same-sex partners, you know, there's still a lot of things to take away from this in understanding. Lots of great stuff. So anyway, I salute you all and just excited. I'm excited about what's happening with the show. I'm excited about that you're here and just looking forward to, you know what, the next call. Got some great guests coming up. And guess what, guess what, guess what? We hit 81 countries today. 81 countries. How did this get 81 countries? I only put it on Facebook. I haven't told anyone yet. You can help out though. You know, you can share this with your friends, your families, your loved ones. Go on, tell them. Tell them to come in and have a listen, you know, and there's going to be something for everyone. So if you don't love one, that's all right. You'll love the next one. And if you don't love that one, there'll be another one right behind that. And you know what? We're going to keep coming to you because we got a dream that this is going to be around for a very, very, very long time. And that, you know, there's gazillions of great stories out there. Stories of wonder, stories of how ordinary people do extraordinary things, how ordinary people create these stories in their life that truly, truly, truly are worth listening to. And within that, we can all take something away and lead what I'd like to say is a really, truly kick-ass life.
That was kick-ass.